One of the points that I noted in that program was that the CIA, as well as the State Department, had warned that if the Shah was admitted to the United States, that an embassy takeover was a probability. So this was anything but a surprise. In fact, it was predicted. And then when Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller, among others, prevailed on Jimmy Carter, it raises questions about where their real allegiance lay at the time.
That's correct. Now,
go ahead.
We also know that from August 1979, the intelligence briefing was provided to Ibrahim Yazdi and also another man, Amir Intizam.
Now, spell his name for us, Farah.
Sorry?
Spell his name. By the way, as we go through the interview, bear in mind that most Americans are not familiar with these names, even most Americans that keep up on current affairs, and that's relatively unusual. So we're, as you know, so I want to fill in as much of the meat on the bones of this discussion as we proceed as possible, because your degree of expertise and your familiarity with Iranian events so far outstretches anything that the average American has. I think one of the things we have to be careful of is going beyond the understanding of our listeners, even though we have a very knowledgeable audience here concerning national security affairs, but many of these names will be new to them. Could you repeat that person's name and spell
sure.
it for us?
Amir Intizam is A-M-I-R,
mm-hmm.
and Intizam is E-N-T-E-Z-A-M, and Ibrahim Yazdi is, I think that I already...
Yeah, we spelled him before, right?
Yes. Now, on August 8th, a memo regarding the exchange of information was sent from Secretary of State Vance. Of course, now this has been prepared by Henry Precht at the State Department to the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. It is stated that on August 5th, the new Iranian ambassador to Sweden, Amir Intizam, was introduced to CIA official George K. by John D. Stemple, who was the deputy chief political officer at the American Embassy in Tehran, also a CIA analyst. I quote, "The strong continuing interest in the exchange of intelligence information with U.S. regarding possible internal threat to provisional government of Iran with external support." It goes on. He said, "Decision to engage the discussion had personally been approved by Ayatollah Khomeini." Close quote. Now, Cave's meeting on August 5th with Intizam initiated a flurry of their private shuttle diplomacy that it developed the contact with Khomeini's advisor in Tehran, Paris, and Stockholm. And many documents shows that on October 79, Cave passed on a great deal of intelligence to Khomeini's CIA-connected aides, including Ibrahim Yazdi and Intizam.
So when you're talking about shuttle diplomacy here, what you're talking about are contacts really between elements of state and elements of CIA and the Khomeini Islamic fundamentalist forces in Iran at the very time that the Shah is still ostensibly, at least, in power, and the Carter administration is supporting the Shah.
No. That is in 1979.
Right.
Shah is already out of Iran. We're talking about 1979, August 8, 1979.
Oh, right. I shouldn't say the Shah, but the Bakhtiar government.
No, Bakhtiar government.
He's gone, too, at this point?
Gone.
Okay, he's gone,
right
too.
Right now, in the time of Iranian history,
mm-hmm.
which... the Shah has left Iran in January 16, 1979.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we went through the first American hostage taking, which it was February 14, 1979.
Right.
We're talking about the provisional government of Iran, which it was Mehdi Bazargan, was placed in Iran. And now we are talking about during the provisional government of Iran, from August 1979 to October 1979, quite a bit of intelligence briefing is being provided to Khomeini's close circle, and particularly Ibrahim Yazdi.
Now, was this with the knowledge and approval of Carter or not?
I don't believe that Carter administration, Carter himself, knew that this intelligence briefing was taking place because... of the role that we find out later on that George Cave played when he went to Iran on May 25th, 1986 with Bart McFarlane and Oliver North and Imran Nir in a deal for armed for hostages. Now, I am not very certain, and I am almost sure that President Carter was not aware of this intelligence briefing by George Cave to Khomeini's close circle, particularly Ibrahim Yazdi.
So basically we have contacts between U.S. intelligence and Khomeini's people at this time, very possibly, not definitely, but very possibly going on without the knowledge of Carter.
That's correct.
Okay, go ahead.
Now, what is also important, to what extent Henry Precht has tried to protect Ibrahim Yazdi. We talked about this last week, that on October 8, 1979, he sent a priority communique to U.S. Embassy in Iran, that is Henry Precht, stating, quote, "Iran's foreign minister has plainly determined to create a strong impression of the Islamic revolutionaries as new breed of man." And he goes on to say, "If Yazdi is to have any influence on political future in Iran, he must protect himself against the charge that he is America's number one agent." Close quote. Now, we also know that earlier in June of 1979, when the question of Ibrahim Yazdi being an American citizen was raised by the American officials at the American embassy in Tehran, and there was a cable that he was sent by the U.S. embassy, it stated that, quote, "We can..." The question was asked, what should they answer in regard to Ibrahim Yazdi if the media would ask about his connection with the United States, whether he is actually American citizen or not? Beck answers, quote, "We cannot confirm that he is a U.S. citizen.
His
passport files are confidential and protected by the Privacy Act. We cannot therefore confirm or deny reports of any information in these files." Close quote. Of course, as we know, this was not the case when they were trying to find out whether President
Clinton
went to Soviet Union or he was in England.
Now, this concerns the possible American citizenship of Yazdi?
That's correct, because he was actually an American citizen.
And he became under Khomeini. What was his role under Khomeini? His position?
He became Khomeini's deputy prime minister,
right,
and later on became Khomeini's foreign minister.
And this was an American citizen?
That's correct.
Fascinating. Go ahead.
Again, Henry Precht was asked, if in fact Dr. Yazdi is U.S. citizen, has he lost his U.S. citizenship by any action he has taken? If so, the State Department... Is the State Department in the process of revoking his citizenship? And Henry Precht answered, I quote, "As I indicated previously, if we had any information on this question, it would be protected by the Privacy Act." Close quote. Now, we have to understand, to what extent did Mr. Henry Precht, as a choke point at the State Department, placed there by the friends of Mr. Bush and also Richard Helms, was trying to protect Ibrahim Yazdi.
So Yazdi at this point would appear to have been a car designate of the United States in the Islamic fundamentalist government that was shaping up.
That's correct.
Okay, and he would then, this net, again, I want to reiterate for the audience, because there are a lot of elements here that the audience would not be familiar with. Obviously, there are gaps in my own understanding, and it's been a while since these things transpired, Farah, and I find my own memory in certain places obviously has lapsed. But this is Ibrahim Yazdi, Khomeini's deputy foreign minister, who is an American citizen, and that fact is being protected by Henry Precht at the U.S. State Department, according to your information.
Yes, allow me to correct you. He was a deputy prime minister at the beginning, and then he became the Iran foreign minister.
Okay.
Now, one other important issues over here that we have not discussed is the American secret files that it was left at the American embassy. Now, these files played a very important role in discrediting all those moderates or the National Front leaders or Bazargan and some of his aides who have had a contact with American embassy and some of the CIA officials while they were in Iran. This this is quite significant, which I have referred to this, the ping pong embassy files. Now, Ambassador Sullivan, in his book, Mission to Iran, has stated that we had already, I quote, we had already over the preceding 2 weeks of February 14, 1979, taken measures to pack up and ship home most of classified documents in the embassy files. The only items remaining were those that they were operationally necessary for daily functions, close quote. Shortly after the February 14 attack on American embassy, Sullivan wanted to be sure that the remaining files were safely out of Iran or destroyed. Now, at the same day that February 14 that the embassy came under attack, he states, I quote, I also checked with my communication people and discovered to my relief that they, he means the embassy personnel, had managed to destroy all documents stored in the vault. Now, that is actually his references to February 14, 1979. So by this time, we know most of the sensitive files are out of Iran.
Okay.
Now, the surprise. Gary Six confirms William Sullivan's statement, but he goes and acknowledges something very, very significant. What does he say? He says, I quote, it is unknown to anyone in the White House when the embassy reconstituted after the February 14 attack, the various agencies shipped back many of the boxes of original file. As a result, when the crisis began to mount in October, the embassy found itself with a massive quantity of papers to be protected, which included voluminous accumulation of years of memos, papers, and reports, close quote. Now, the evidence shows that the embassy documents were edited in order to cast a bad light on the members of the Bazargan, maybe Bazargan is B-A-Z-A-R-J-A-N, who was the interim government, by making it appear that they were the one that they had a duplicitous contact with CIA. This information contained, the information that was contained in this file was another tool provided by the pro-Bush loyalists within the intelligence community to their fundamentalist allies for use against their competitors in Iran.
So what you're suggesting is that information was deliberately left in the files at the U.S. Embassy, which would discredit the Bazargan government?
And all the people close to him that they were in contact with the American Embassy. But however, this information, when it was used against those individuals within the National Front or the LMI, Liberation Movement of Iran, who had been in contact with the officials of the so-called Great Satan, and what they refer to Great Satan is President Carter. The files were also used to attack and embarrass President Carter that how incompetent his administration was that left all these files at the American Embassy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the
basically what we're looking at is information suggesting, and again, you were initially quoted from Ambassador Sullivan, and then you read the information from Gary Six's book.
Correct.
Would indicate, if I'm following you correctly, Farr, this would indicate that the U.S. deliberately left information on hand, and the finger would seem to point in the direction of William Sullivan.
That is precisely what I'm talking about, because in those files, originally, there had been information that would provide enough light on the contacts that was developed between Khomeini's close circle, like Ayatollah Beheshti and quite a few other Ayatollahs, with American Embassy and also with the CIA. But all those information were taken out. So the only information that they were left in were the National Front and the LMI members that they were in contact with the CIA and American Embassy. And that is, and also the contact that the CIA had with Mr. Rafsanjani, that presently he is the president of Iran, and his name is spelled R-A-F-S-A-N-J-N-I. And there are quite a few others, other Ayatollahs that their name also was among those files, but they were all taken out.
So now, what you're saying is that some of the information, now, again, the files were left on hand, but you're saying that some of the information was taken out?
That's correct.
And other information was deliberately left in, and the information left in not only discredited the moderate forces in Iran, the Bazargan government, but also discredited the Carter administration, because this indicated that Jimmy Carter was incompetent, et cetera, et cetera.
That's correct.
Okay, now, how can you document that far? I'm not casting aspersions on that.
No, let me tell you how.
Okay.
There is an assertion, and also talking to Mr. Banisad, the former Iranian president,
mm-hmm.
he believes that the Khomeini's forces themselves, they took all these files that contain information about Khomeini's close circle like Ayatollah Beheshti, Rafsanjani, and quite a few others, and they gave it to Khomeini, and he kept it under his mattress. And this is the exact quote from former President Banisad. I do not believe that. Because if that was the case, the copy of all this information were also in the position of the CIA or other American agencies that they kept file on the contact with these individuals. Now, if the allegation were true, then why did the CIA not use this perfect opportunity to blackmail the fundamentalists into releasing the hostages? Because they knew that Ayatollah Beheshti and Rafsanjani were in charge of the destiny and the future of the hostages. The reason for that is because the actual file was not in the hand of the people within the Carter administration that they could have even used it as a blackmail against the fundamentalists to get the release of the hostages. That's the reason.
Oh, so that basically, again, we're looking at elements of the U.S. national security establishment operating behind the back of the Carter administration. By leaving those files unsanitized, they were discrediting, they were basically achieving goals, both two of the major goals of this alliance, namely destabilizing the Carter administration and bringing the Khomeini forces to power in Iran by discrediting the moderates.
That's correct.
Okay.
And all the competitors and all the rivals. Now, in September 5th, 1979, we refer to this memo. There was a memo sent by Henry Precht to Iran outlining the Carter policy of what future they are looking for in order to establishing contacts with the Iranian moderates. And I quote, "Over the long term, we will want to work for an Iran in which the moderate secular nationalists are predominant in managing the country. But before we can exercise influence in Iran, we must develop a position of trust and respect." Close quote. What is the significance of that? The significance is that Carter administration was looking to a future relationship that the clergy or the fundamentalists were not in control of the political movement in Iran, and they were not the absolute rulers of Iran. They were talking about the secular government.
So the Carter administration was pushing for a secular government to succeed the Shah, which obviously would have been at variance with the CIA policy of supporting the fundamentalists.
That's correct.
Okay.
Now, this is some documents that I'm going to read you. On September 22nd, 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini gave a speech to the university students, and this actually is printed in one of the daily newspapers in Iran, Etlaat, and it's spelled, the name of the newspaper is ITTILAAT. Now, I'm quoting exactly the word that Ayatollah Khomeini used. Quote, "Those intellectuals who say that the clergy should leave politics and go back to mosque speak on the behalf of Satan," close quote.
Meaning the United States.
You understand the significance of this, David?
Mm-hmm.
The Carter administration had a policy, and this information somehow gets to Khomeini, and Khomeini in turn goes on, and, you know, publicly, stating that whoever is coming up with a story, even among the Iranians, that the clergy should go and practice religion and leave the politics to the professional, like the secular government, they are speaking on the behalf of Satan.
Now, could this have something to do with the contacts that you mentioned between George Cave and the Khomeini people, in which he was getting the intelligence briefings?
Very good possibility.
Now, this
how else would they know?
And those contacts again took place in August of 79?
That is the August of 79.
Right. Okay, go ahead.
Now, while Carter held to this policy, the pro-Bush loyalists held their own private policy and worked out diligently with Ayatollah Khomeini's inner circle to achieve their common objective. They utilized their exclusive foreknowledge of the Shah's cancer to plan that so-called drama. They selected the major actors and manipulated the Iran's revolutionary process.
Mm-hmm.
Carter administration was laced with all the different choke points now, and said nothing but disinformation about the reality of the conditions which was taking place in Iran. Who were these choke points? We go from the top to the bottom. We have got Deputy Director Frank Carlucci. We had Bob Gates. We have George Cave at the CIA. We had General Eugene Tite, who was at the Defense Intelligence Agency. We had General Howard Fish and Eric von Marbot, Richard Secor at the Defense Department, they were all a part of the DSAA. And then we had Donald Gregg at the National Security Council. We had Harold Saunders and Henry Precht at the State Department. And we had William Sullivan and John D. Stemple at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. And coincidentally, many of these people were rewarded by Reagan administration by medals or the new job when Reagan took office.
Now, I'm interested, you mentioned that General Tai was somehow involved in going behind Carter's back?
That's correct. That is T-I-G-H-E, Jr. at the Defense Intelligence Agency.
Right. I'm familiar with the individual. I'm just wondering now, what documentation do you have on that?
Well, because some of the things that I have found out about the deals that was being made between the information on the defense intelligence, because in later part of 1978, the Defense Intelligence Agency prepared a document on the conditions in Iran. The man who prepared or supposed to prepare that documents or findings of the situation in Iran in 1978 during the height of the Iranian Revolution, met with a man in Iran whose name is Gene Wheaton, and I'm not very sure whether you know who he is.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And he's also familiar to a certain extent, at least to the members of this audience. Gene Wheaton is a longtime U.S. intelligence operative who has been very critical of many of the operations conducted under the rubric of the Iran-Contra, well, not under the rubric, but which have been subsumed under the rubric of the Iran-Contra scandal.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Now, we also have to mention that Gene Wheaton served in Iran in different capacities, working with the SAVAK and also working with Rockwell International, and he was the man in charge of the security of the IBEX program at Rockwell International. And he, according to him, he met with the man from the Defense Intelligence Agency that was preparing that finding, and he took him around the city and showed him all the trouble spot and told him that the days of the Shah's are numbered because Iran is going through a revolutionary process.
Mm-hmm.
However, when that document came out, it exactly reflected the opposite.
The document, so there was the information given
to Carter.
To the Carter was different than the information given to the DIA.
That's correct.
Okay.
So that is one of the reasons that the people at the Defense Intelligence Agency, even when they provided information about Iran to President Carter, that was also disinformation.
Okay. All righty. Now, do you know, can you link that with General Tai personally, or is it simply coming from DIA?
Because it came from a DIA, and I believe that information could have not been gathered together and provided to President Carter unless it would have been approved by the general himself.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Now, the tension both in Tehran and Washington increased during that summer, and the decision was made to replace the embassy personnel who had dealt with the Shah and Bakhtiar government, of course, that goes. And by the summer, only two of the persons who had been at the embassy on the February 14th remained in Iran. Now, we know that while Carter administration doggedly proceeded in its determination to deal only with Bazargan government, the pro-Bush group were actively promoting Khomeini. Now, we also know that you mentioned that as the year wore on, as you very well put it together, was that Henry Kissinger, Rockefeller, and McCloy, all these three individuals were trying to force Carter to let Shah to come to United States.
And this knowing, or I should say, with abundant intelligence information that this would precipitate a takeover of the U.S. Embassy.
That's correct.
And again, in Radio Free America 31, this was some of the information that I cited in pointing out the probability that the hostage crisis itself may very well have been deliberately precipitated by elements in the United States hostile to Carter. Hence, that's one of the reasons why the broadcast was entitled The Destabilization of the Carter Administration. Okay, go ahead.
Now, on October 19, 1979, in a moment of anger and frustration, President Jimmy Carter asked his closest advisors, then pressuring him to admit the Shah to the United States. And I quote, he asked, "What are you guys going to advise me to do if they overrun our embassy and take our people hostages?" Close quote. Now, what is really significant over here, that you see that in one hand, knowing that what danger is ahead, and there is also a possibility of hostages to be taken, but Carter came under so much pressure to admit the Shah to the United States. According to Banisad, in his book, My Turn to Speak, he says, from the beginning, the hostages affair was handled illogically. How was it that Khomeini and his aides planned the embassy takeover without considering the internal, regional, and international context? They exhibited a rare lack of foresight by doing nothing to protect our resources or our money. We knew what was in store for us, yet no one did anything about it. And he goes on to a lot of other things.
Okay, Farah, you know what I'm going to do at this point? I think it would be worthwhile to take a short break here just to give our audience a chance to stretch and refresh their powers of concentration. We've been talking for about an hour and 20 minutes. I'd like to take a short break and put you on hold, and then we'll resume the discussion after that.
That's fine.
I think it'll be good for the audience. Be good for me, too, frankly.
Okay. I can get a glass of water.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll take a break here, and we'll all of us refresh our intellects and physiologies, and then we'll come back with renewed vigor. Okay?
Thank you.
Very good. And again, we will be resuming our discussion with Farah Mansour. Obviously, this is taking a good portion of the program. It will take up a good deal of the rest of the program. But this is vital information, and I'm going into this not only as part of Radio Free America 38 and 31, but with a new administration with the first Democratic administration since Jimmy Carter having assumed power, and with many of the same elements in place, and certainly the national security infrastructure that removed Jimmy Carter is still there. I think we need to learn the lessons of history if we're going to avoid a repetition of the past. In any event, we're going to take a musical break now, and then we're going to come back with more of our interview with Farah Mansour. Back live on the airwaves, and by the way, I've been able to correct our technical problem here. The submarine effect that I've been wrestling with is gone, so you're coming in loud and clear.
Now,
okay, we got real good sound quality here. Now, when we left off with the discussion, this was in October, I believe you said October 19th, of 1979, when Jimmy Carter was inquiring in anger, what happens if I admit the Shah to the United States and our embassy is taken over, indicating that he knew, obviously, of the possibility, also reflecting the pressures on him at the time.
Yes.
Okay, that's where we are at this point. Go ahead.
given this, many observers have questioned why Carter did admit the Shah into the United States. What is more baffling is why Rockefeller, Kissinger, McCloy, and others, all very busy and over-committed individuals, invested so much of their valuable time and resources on this pro-Shah campaign. And that the Rockefeller-Kissinger group realized they would expose the to public scrutiny and criticism, yet went ahead with their giant lobby and their effort to pressure Carter to allow him, to allow Shah to be admitted to the United States. In August of 1979, Precht promised Bruce Langen, the embassy charge of her in Iran, that the mission would be consulted when the Shah, before the Shah would be admitted into the United States or for medical treatment. However, we find out, according to former hostage Morehead Kennedy, that that fateful decision which threatened the embassy staff was made in Washington at least without any consultation. While the Shah was in New York, Precht flew to Tehran for a brief visit, concealing his knowledge that some of the Washington were really worried about an attack, and he did nothing to enhance the embassy's security, even though that he sent his findings that we talked about it, that the security has to be actually more beefed up. On October 21st, the CIA station in Tehran alerted his counterpart in Paris that the Shah's imminent arrival to U.S. would make certain difficulties. And there's a cable that I go to read that. It says, quote, since reference B have learned that Amir Entezam took part in meeting with Charge and Mr. Henry Precht had with Premier Bazargan and Foreign Minister Yazdi to pass message on the Shah's stay health and imminent arrival in United States. Amir Entezam's reaction was that this development would make more difficult effort for those who have been trying to improve relations with the United States. Since Amir Entezam fully appraised for the Shah out-of-state plan, it may not be necessary to advise him that Mr. Cave has important intelligence for him. Advise whether headquarters, the CIA headquarters, still wants station to alert Entezam that Mr. Cave wants to meet him in Europe as possible and 21st October, all secret. Now, nevertheless, as we have found out, on October 23rd, 1979, the Shah was admitted to the United States. This was done without consulting the U.S. Embassy in Tehran or increasing any protection for the embassy official.
Now, you're saying that at this point, there was no increased security at the U.S. Embassy?
There were not added security at the American Embassy.
Okay, this despite the fact that obviously from the information you presented, the distinct possibility was on the horizon that there might be an attempt to take over the embassy.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, let me one more question, something I did not understand, Farah. The allusion to the intelligence that George Cave, again, a CIA person who later came into the Iran-Contra scandal as part of the mission to Iran to the so-called moderates in 86. But the intelligence that he would have had for Amir Entezam, what did that refer to? I didn't catch that.
Really, I don't know. But what I do know is, based on my investigation, it was not as important that the intelligence briefing was provided to Entezam. But what was important was that the intelligence briefing was presented to Yazdi, Ibrahim Yazdi, who was the foreign minister as well.
Okay, and this intelligence briefing was provided by George Cave.
That's correct.
Now, this is different than the one in August of 79?
Between August to October 1979,
mm-hmm.
Various intelligence briefing was provided to Ibrahim Yazdi and Intezam.
Okay.
Now, what we know, though, that Ibrahim Yazdi, he received all these intelligence briefings. As I said, so did Amir Entizam. But Amir Entizam ended up in jail for being called a CIA agent for the same intelligence briefing that he received, as well as Ibrahim Yazdi. But we see Ibrahim Yazdi free, coming and going.
Yazdi,
why is that?
And of course, Entizam is a moderate. Yazdi is more aligned with the Islamic fundamentalists, the extremists. And Yazdi also an American citizen, you say?
Yes.
Right.
You got it. And I asked this question from Banisat in my interview with him. He started laughing and then he said, yeah, I asked Khomeini the same question. And I told him that how is it that we know a lot more about Ibrahim Yazdi? He is even suspected to be the America's number one agent. We have got a lot of materials on him. But you have put Entizam in jail, but you have not put Ibrahim Yazdi in jail.
And again, we should reiterate, Farah, we've already covered it a few times, but repeat for the benefit of the audience, and we may have some people tuning in, Ibrahim Yazdi's position within the Khomeini government, bearing in mind that this is an American citizen. Go ahead.
He was a pro-fundamentalist, and he wanted to share the aspiration of the fundamentalist absolute rule in Iran, whereby Entizam was more of a national front, supposedly, leader, that whose aspiration was a secular government in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
A cable that is dated on October 31st, 1979, from Tehran to its headquarters, reveals the sensitivity of George Kaver's 11-hour mission to Iran, which it was a part of a document that I believe 2 weeks ago you read on the air, which it says, proposed extension of George Kaver's visit raises question of his safety, and of Amir Entizam expressed concern about the manipulation of revolution. Knowing no more than we do here about his tours, must defer to him and the CIA headquarters for consideration of personal security implication of a series of operational contacts. Regarding possible political fallout, we think there are substantial risks involved, and the charge, which they are referring to Bruce Lingham, advises that he's also concerned, because I believe that the charge really didn't know what the mission of George Kaver in reality was.
This would have been the Bruce Langen, then?
That's correct.
Right, the chargé d'affaires at the U.S. Embassy. Go ahead.
He assumed that Kaver's prolonged presence could not be concealed from the Iranians. Of course, they are talking about those that they were unaware of his secret mission on the behalf of the alliance.
Mm-hmm. And the alliance being the CIA Fundamentalist Alliance.
That's correct. CIA pro-Bush and the Fundamentalist Alliance.
Right.
And that no inadequate pretext such as tourism would be credible, because he was using that as a cover that he is going there as a tourist. At least some of his proposed contact would therefore presumably have to be declared, and that's what they're talking about. It has to be declared to Entizam and the company, even to Bazargan.
Okay, by the way, Farah, at some point in the discussion, I would like to get to the role. It's something we touched on when I read the circular letter 2 weeks ago, but the role of Warren Christopher, who, of course, is the Secretary of State under Bill Clinton.
Yes. I think that you are referring to the documents that I have cited in regard to the Warren Christopher's knowledge of the briefing officer, Robert Clayton Ames, which it was actually, I believe, that it was August 2nd, 1979. That communication was sent by Henry Precht, the director of Iran Desk at the State Department, but it was signed by Warren Christopher. Now, that cable concluded that in order to permit evaluation of risks and benefit of those contacts, request CIA headquarters to identify them for us and indicate which one of them would be declared. Now, the cable actually in reality is showing that Entizam was being cut out of the information loop. Now we have got November 1st, 1979. 1979, on November, the charge affair, which is Bruce Langen, of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, wrote to his family about the huge demonstration of the U.S. Embassy building that morning. He described how even the highly organized effort to defend the compound by heavily armed U.S. Marine Guard proved futile. In an interview for this project with the U.S. intelligence insider, which we talked about him, Gene Wheaton, discloses that the planning for the second embassy takeover, this is according to Gene,
mm-hmm.
quote, was known in advance for several days. Gene says, I quote, I learned about the plan in advance when I was in U.S. I had inside contact over in Iran to keep me informed. I was letting the people know about it. I was suggesting that they either beef up the embassy or get the people out,
mm-hmm.
destroy the documents, or move them out of the country. They just didn't want to hear the information. But I can guarantee to you that I was informing the people that they needed to know. They were a part of the government. I reported this to the appropriate people and nothing was done. Obviously, that's the end of the quote. He deliberately was ignored. Now we are getting to the point that we are getting closer to the November 4th. Now we have to see all the events that is taking place. It is not that they didn't know that this may happen, but they knew, but nothing was done. By November, realizing that there would be no U.S. military reaction to an embassy takeover,
mm-hmm.
because the first takeover was done as a test run to see what they had, quite a few objectives. Number one, they wanted to see whether there would be any reaction by the Carter administration. They found out there was none.
Mm-hmm.
They also wanted to know who are the obstacles into taking of American embassy or attack American embassy and taking the hostages. And they found out General Karani was one, Ayatollah Taleghani was another one, and there was another Ayatollah. All these people were murdered before this.
Hmm? They were all put to death between the St. Valentine's Day massacre of February 14th, 79 takeover, and the November 4th.
That's correct.
Okay, repeat the names again for the benefit of our audience.
Now, it was General Vali Karani.
Okay, spelled.
That's the two different spelling is Q-A-R-A-N-I, and it could be also G-H-A-R-N-I.
Okay.
And also we have got Ayatollah Taleghani, which is T-A-L, and it could be Q-A-N-I, Taleghani, or it could be G-H-A-N-I.
Taleghani? Okay.
Right.
Go ahead.
Now, on several occasions, I believe that Gene Wheaton provided very sensitive information to officials within the intelligence community to warn them of impending security problem or risk, but nobody wanted to listen, and he was told to back off.
Mm-hmm.
He has said that Sullivan was, this is according to Gene Wheaton, that Sullivan blocking all the information and President Carter was isolated. And I believe so was the Shah.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, the three people, Karani, Taleghani, and who was the third? They're just backtracking a bit.
The other one was Ayatollah Motahari.
Okay, and how's that spelled?
It's M-O-T-A-H-A-R-I.
All right, and all three of these people were opposed to takeover of the U.S. Embassy. This demonstrated by the February 14th takeover, and they were murdered between February and November when the real, I guess we could say, takeover took place?
That's correct.
Okay, go ahead.
November 1st, 1979, on the 25th anniversary of the Algerian Independence Day, Brzezinski met with Iranian officials in Algiers.
Right. In fact, a listener called up during the break point to go over this particular meeting. This is in the October Surprise Task Force report,
right,
by the way. Go ahead.